10th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Olympic Games are underway in Rio, and there's no shortage of media-related topics to talk about. For instance, what new things are journalists trying this year to keep up interest online, in print, and on TV? Why does it seem that the media is having such a hard time covering the female athletes, calling them girls instead of women, making unintentionally sexist comments during play-by-play, tying this, their success to their husbands? And then there's the story of Michael Phelps. No one seems to be able to get enough of Michael Phelps. We'll talk about some other non-Olympic stuff as well, such as Fox News after Roger Ailes, including the parade of women who've come forward alleging a hostile work environment, claims that he used company money to spy on critics, and what might come next now that he's out of the picture. And we'll talk a little bit about the presidential race as well and what's gone on there in the past few days. Hopefully a lot more that we'll get to as well, but I want to start by talking about Sunday night's installment of the HBO show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. We've talked in the past about his biting take on the news and that no matter how many times he says his show isn't journalism, how often his staff does a stellar job of it. Sunday night, in my opinion, was no exception. The show was basically a 19-minute love letter to the local newspaper. He talked about how vital newspapers are to keeping those with power and influence honest, and that, in his words, the media is a food chain that would fall apart without local newspapers. His setup was classic, using excerpts from the movie Spotlight and showing us how a handful of enterprising reporters in Boston brought down an archdiocese and uncovered a priest's sex abuse scandal that spanned the globe. But then Oliver got into the harsh realities of the newspaper business, declining circulations, lower ad revenues, layoffs, reorganizations.
None of this is to say that there aren't people producing great work in local newsrooms right now. Many are at the Oregonian, at the Review Journal, even at fucking Tronc. But they are doing it despite their current conditions. And the truth is, a big part of the blame for this industry's dire straits is on us, and our unwillingness to pay for the work journalists produce. We've just grown accustomed to getting our news for free. And the longer that we get something for free, the less willing we are to pay for it. And I'm talking to you, the person watching this segment on YouTube, using the Wi-Fi from the coffee shop underneath your apartment. You're killing us! But sooner or later, we are either going to have to pay for journalism or we are all going to pay for it. Because if we don't, not only will malfeasance run amok, but the journalism movies of the future are going to look a lot more like this.
And you can see what this looks like if you go to our links blog at kbia.org. You'll see what he puts in that next segment is a trailer for the fictional movie Stoplight. What our world could look like if people aren't willing to start paying for good journalism. Mike, you emailed me right after you had an opportunity to watch this on Monday, and your response was literally two words. It was spot on.
It was. I mean, he did a really good job of talking about the importance of newspapers, of dissecting the industry. There were a couple of parts that I really liked. I thought that his takedown of sort of corporate speak, you know, like what was it, content optimization and artificial intelligence and strange graphics that didn't actually do anything, was all spot on. I mean, those things are important if we have good quality local journalism to apply those different techniques to, but by themselves, it's just a lot of jargon. And I also liked what he had to say about state government reporting and how it is particularly imperiled by the fact that newspapers are struggling. I mean, he quoted David Simon, who produced The Wire, as basically saying it's going to be a golden age for corruption. And I think that's quite likely going to be true.
Yeah, and I think you're starting to see a lot of that go on in terms of the state reporting, the local reporting, as newspapers sort of, I don't want to say they're dying out, but they don't have the kinds of staff, they don't have the size of staffs needed to be able to cover this. One of the things that I also liked about him is that he was being very frank about the fact that the public has a lot to do with what's happening with this. The fact that we are willing to, for whatever reason, and basically it's because it's free. I mean, if it's free, we're not gonna pay for it. And now that newspapers are putting up paywalls, people are going to other places to get their news.
And that's exactly the point he was trying to make that we heard in that clip. This show being an HBO program that's being put on YouTube, that is a subscription-based service that people are kind of, sort of, even if the program itself is facilitating it, kind of sort of stealing it in that same way.
That is true. But on the other hand, it is also true that we gave it away.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
For way too long.
Okay. No, that to me, that is the biggest issue. And now we all of a sudden want to, and I say we, I'm talking about the media organizations, the media corporations, want to sort of pull it back. And people are not saying, well, hey, okay, we'll pay for it now. They're not going to do that. Yeah. I mean, that's not going to happen.
And David Chevron, who is with the Newspaper Association of America, didn't really appreciate Oliver's tone, didn't appreciate the message there, and on behalf of that organization wrote a statement saying that if he was going to say these things, the least he could do is offer some kind of a solution, that he did a little bit more than make fun of the people trying to solve
it. Here's the problem I have with that.
Okay.
It's not John Oliver's responsibility to do that. Okay, and to make a statement like that is almost, and I understand that you work for the NAA and mm-hmm. you're supposed to be helping them out, but the problem I have with that is that that's not the way to respond to that. You should talk about, here's some things that we are doing, not the corporate speak that John Oliver pointed out so graphically in his piece, but here are the things that we're doing to try to help local news out, to try to help have more state news, to work with various organizations. Instead, he comes out and he attacks John Oliver. It's almost like, you know, Donald Trump attacking Hillary Clinton and vice versa.
Not only is it not John Oliver's job, but I really get tired of people in our industry always looking to blame somebody besides ourselves for our problems. I mean, Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, was speaking to the NAA at their convention 7 years ago in San Diego, and he had a novel idea when the newspaper industry was criticizing Google for aggregating all their content and not paying for it. He says, you need to be consumer-driven businesses. Find out what your audience wants, and if you satisfy them, you're going to make a lot of money, and if you don't, you're going to go out of business. That's still true today.
That is true. And what's happening is that you see the Washington Post doing innovative things in that area. The New York Times is doing innovative things in that area. Some local newspapers are doing things that is starting to bring readers back. But when you look at the industry from a whole, all you see is these gimmicks like Tronc and those kinds of things that really aren't going to work because you have people who don't understand the industry who are coming up with these ideas.
And by the way, just one last thing. John Oliver says they don't do journalism. And that's kind of the same argument that Jon Stewart used to make on The Daily Show. But the folks at John Oliver's opera, he's got former New York Times staffers mm-hmm. working for him. They take what the media report and then they go out the extra mile.
He can deny it all he wants. And he is staff or journalist.
Well, in a way, he admits that. He says, look, we wouldn't be able to do the things we're doing if it wasn't for the newspaper journalists.
That's how he started this entire 19-minute program.
Started the whole thing off. And it's not just his show, but even the network news, the nightly news cast, the what you see on cable television, they would not be able to do what they do if it wasn't for local news, if it wasn't for the Associated Press.
Okay, well, you had mentioned something about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton attacking each other. And for more than a year, we've been saying that this is the presidential election that is like no other, and that the only thing we can count on is seeing or hearing something we've never seen or heard before, and we've got a new one.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know.
Was that one candidate suggesting, maybe even encouraging, physical violence against another one? And to a lot of people, it sure sounded like it was, as you might expect. Trump blames the dust-up on the media, its bias, its misinterpretation of his words and tone. Former CBS anchor Dan Rather posted a rather long-reasoned response to that on Facebook. In it, he called Trump's words a new low and unprecedented in the history of presidential politics. And he asks what seems like a pretty fair question to me. If any other citizen had made those kind of comments, would the Secret Service be investigating? And for all we know, they are, if we wouldn't likely know if they were.
I mean, truthfully, it doesn't really matter whether this was a calculated statement by Trump or he was just letting his mouth get ahead of his brain, as often the case.
Because that's not happened ever before.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. I mean, he was giving license to somebody with a gun who might be just a little bit crazy to take matters into their own hands if she's elected president. And that's a step too far. I mean, and it raises a lot of really interesting questions that journalists have been talking about for the past few weeks, whether or not we've reached this sort of Murrow moment where it's our job to put aside, quote, objectivity and balance and all of that and just say, this guy's dangerous and it's a journalist's job, like it was when Murrow exposed McCarthy, to tell the truth.
Yeah, I had a conversation with David Mendich, who wrote the piece for in Columbia Journalism mm-hmm. Review about, is this a Murrow moment? And he said he pretty much came up with that because he's starting to see a shift in the media to doing exactly what Murrow was doing, which is calling out Trump and his surrogates when these things happen, and began the investigative part that they probably should have been doing from the beginning. At least we've talked about them
last
doing
13
this,
months.
This from the beginning is do the investigation. What is in his tax records? What does his bankruptcies look like? What are the statements that he's made over the years? What is his upbringing? What those types of things. Let's get a fuller picture of who Donald Trump is so that when he makes these statements, we can put it in the context that it needs to be in. But one of the things that I really, and you can go on our links blog and get this, is a New York Times article that talks about the fact that that journalism needs to look at Trump as a candidate much differently than any other presidential candidate we've looked at before, because of the statements that he makes, the upbringing that he comes from, and the fact that there is a potential for the dangerous kind of actions that could happen if his words become his actions.
See, I agree with all of that, and I think it is a Murrow moment. I do have a few concerns with this whole thing. First of all, a lot of Trump supporters, a lot of mainstream, you know, conservatives and independents say, well, you know, the media have always been in the corner of liberal elites, and so we've got to overcome that concern. I think we have to make sure that if we're going to expose Trump, that we don't do it through innuendo or gossip or shortcuts or conspiracy theories or exaggeration, because that's exactly what Trump mm-hmm. did. And one could argue that's what Dan Rather and his folks did when they were trying to expose George W.'s Texas National Guard record. We have to do fact-based reporting, mm-hmm. not just all this other stuff. Third, I think we can't let Hillary Clinton off the hook.
Oh, I agree with you on that point.
Just because we have to expose Trump. I mean, there's lots of serious questions that we need to ask about her. And then the fourth thing, and you kind of alluded to this, it's a lot harder to have a Murrow moment than it was back in the day. There were far fewer news organizations. Mm-hmm. The news media were thought of more highly by
it's
the
not
public.
It's not as fragmented as it is now.
And now you've reached this fragmented environment where people have fallen into the echo chambers of getting their sources of news from the ones that they agree with, whatever perspective might be coming from it.
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue. And I agree with everything you're saying, Mike, but I also think that what's going to make it, I won't say easier, but for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. easier for journalists to do this, is that you now have Republicans on a daily basis, almost an hourly basis, Republicans in the establishment and even some who are not, who are basically saying, I can't support this candidate.
And are starting to walk away.
And they're
people
starting
from the
to
RNC
walk away. So
away.
That walking away of Republicans from their candidate in some ways can give the media the cover they need to objectively, for lack of a better word, cover, you know, do these stories without this, oh, you're going after, it's the liberal media going after our candidate.
But I mean, even so, if you think that what we hope to accomplish beyond just sort of having a record of history is to change people's behaviors, there's a very tiny sliver of people still, I think, who can be influenced today to believe that this is important.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think we should be doing this to influence. Right. I think we should be doing this to spotlight, to show, to give people the facts that they need in order for them to make the decisions, the decision about who's going to be the next president of the United States.
Quickly, I do want to touch on one thing. Over the weekend, Donald Trump was given an invitation to speak and to meet with journalists at the joint conference of the NABJA, National Association of Black Journalists, and NAH. NAHJ, National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Donald Trump turned down that invitation. Hillary Clinton took it, not only spoke at the conference, but took questions, almost press conference-like, which she hadn't done in months.
Well, yeah, let's be careful about comparing it to a press conference, because there were, I think, five reporters who got to ask questions, handpicked. It's a relatively friendly audience, and the kinds of questions were ones that she was able to deflect with pretty standard pat campaign answers. The one question that was kind of interesting was, even though it's not original, was to tell us about a revealing conversation that you had with a black friend. And she stumbled around with all kinds of political answers rather than personal answers. But I don't think this makes up for the fact that for, you know, the better part of a year, she's not met with journalists who cover politics and government on a regular basis. On the other hand, Hillary doesn't like the media. She hates the media. She thinks that we're unfair. She thinks that all we care about is the horse race and all we care about is the gotcha moments. And, you know, there's enough evidence there that you could see where she's coming from.
Well, but I also think this goes back to the conversation we were having a minute ago about the fragmented media, is the fact that, you know, that Hillary and others, including our current president, have been able to control their message by talking to local television stations and doing other things without having to have these press conferences. And then journalists get upset about that, but we don't control that. We lost that a long time ago. So, you know, I think we need to figure out other ways in which to get to the candidates, get the questions out that really matter, and get some answers that people can really use.
Okay, well, so here we are, almost halfway through week one of the Rio Olympics, and it seems this year there have been almost as many media-related stories to come out of these games as there have been stories of athletic triumph. Let me start by asking you guys, did you watch any of the opening ceremony, that tape delay from one time zone ahead of us?
I missed it. I'm going to be honest. I saw some of the excerpts from it. Uh-huh. I read more stories about...
You saw the Tongan
Yes, I saw that. But I actually read more stories. I got more out of reading the stories than I did from looking at the highlights of it.
I watched the Parade of Nations or whatever it's called. And I was waiting to see the actual sort of entertainment part of it. I did not see Gisele Bündchen walk
you
across
missed it.
The
it
field.
It was all before the parade, and it may have been purposely edited to do so. It's one of the things NBC's caught a lot of flack for this time around, how much of these games are tape delayed, given that they are occurring in a time zone where our country lives.
You know, I mean, 2 hours ahead of our central time zone. There are lots of things that they can cover live, and they are swimming, beach volleyball,
gymnastics.
Frankly, I mean, some of it actually, the women's gymnastics from yesterday
really surprised by that one.
And, you know, they're trying to maximize their audience. They spend a boatload of money to have years and years of exclusive rights to the broadcasts. They know that their formula of focusing on Americans and focusing on moments and these heart-rending stories, it works for them. It sure leaves out a lot of time for us to hear about other sports besides the ones that Americans dominate.
But I think what's happening is that they are also realizing that they can maximize viewership in other areas, streaming, that sort of thing. And whereas news organizations and media organizations once would defer to whoever was running the Olympics and not give who the winners were when they're different time zones and that sort of thing, that's gone. That's over. Everyone else is like,
NBC is still trying to play that game just a little bit.
Oh, yeah, they're trying to play
it. They've got $1.2 billion invested in that.
You know, I'm waiting to see when there's going to be a really serious, if ever, you know, discussion about any of the problems in Rio de Janeiro. I mean, there was this fawning article in the Washington Post last week about Bob Costas and what a great journalist and host he is. And yet, there was more time spent talking yesterday about how strangely the water in the diving pool turned green than stories about all of the virus-filled waters that the rowers and the sailors and the triathletes are swimming in and maybe going to cause health problems. When are they going to talk about any of this?
Well, they were doing a lot of stories about security issues leading up to it. And now that the Olympics have started, there's no stories about security issues. And I can't believe that there's not something.
That it all alleviated itself.
Or the housing problem, the huge housing problem they were having before that. All those stories sort of went away once the Olympic torch was lit.
Having said all of that, you know, though, every time I hear that music that started back with Jim McKay and ABC when they covered, every time I hear that, it just, you know, swells up a little bit. I love the Olympic music.
So here's one issue that people have been talking about a lot online. I know the Chicago Tribune was one that had to issue an apology for this earlier this week. Some of the women winning different medals or having different achievements in the Olympics, being connected and having their success connected directly to their husband's success. And in that case of the Chicago Tribune, I bring it up. Corey Kajal Unreen, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right, but won a bronze medal in a shooting competition. And Chicago Tribune noted, instead of putting her name in there, the wife of a Bears linebacker wins a medal.
Yeah, that was purely sexist. I think some of the other comments, like when in the swimming, they were talking about, you know, one of the coaches of the athlete being her husband, or in beach volleyball, one of the coaches being, okay, they are integral to their success if they're their coaches, and we probably ought to cut a little slack. I'll also say, talking about sexism, okay, all the female anchors hanging on to the shirtless, greased-up Tongan sign carrier, that's a little sexist, too.
Yeah. Some are saying, you know, some will say girls, some will say women.
Right.
You know, you go back and forth on that. I think it's part of sometimes the anchors and the announcers get so caught up in covering the sport that I think they lose sight of the way in which they describe some of the athletes, in particular the women athletes. So I think that there needs to be some more training
Where do you go with that in making sure that you're always involving the person first language? I mean, that comes back to the athlete who is the wife of, or the women's gymnastics team. We have two women who are over 18, three women who aren't. So they would technically be girls.
Well, I mean, you have the entire women's gymnastics team, with the exception, I would say, of one, who could be technically said they're girls.
Right. I think Allie Raisman's also over 18.
Allie,
so
Gabby Douglas is over. So you've got three out of the two.
Yeah.
And so you get, like I say, you get so caught up in covering them, and you've been covering them since they were girls,
mm-hmm.
that you sort of still carry that language all the way through.
Some of that is a close call, but some of it, like you talk about the gymnastics team,
yeah.
whether they're girls or women. Or they could just be standing around at the mall. I mean, that's sexist no matter how.
I did hear that, and I was like, oh, that was not good.
Okay, well, the last time we were on the air, Gretchen Carlson's claims of sexual harassment at Fox News were just starting to come out, and it was still unclear what would happen. Well, since then, Roger Ailes has seen his ouster, and now we're hearing from a steady stream of women who say they were either harassed, intimidated, or faced retaliation during their employ there. Now we're even hearing stories that Ailes used Fox News funds to go after some of his professional enemies. Enemies, if you will, trying to get intelligence.
Are we really surprised?
No.
I'm not surprised by any of this. Roger Ailes leaves,
mm-hmm.
and you had you have Murdoch's sons who are basically trying to figure out how we're going to get a hold of what's going on in Fox News. And one of the ways to do that is you've taken Ailes out. Now you got to take out all of the people who are under him who still want to continue to do those types of things. And I think you're going to see a continuation of this unless Daddy Murdoch steps in and goes like, well, wait a minute. The purge is over. We need to get back to business, which could possibly happen.
You talk about not being surprised, Ernest. I mean, are you surprised that Roger Ailes, who got his start, or at least was well known for working for the Nixon administration, had his own enemies list and had resources that he applied
to
spy? I mean, we even had Brian Stelter, you know, who was a media critic before he worked for the New York Times or CNN, saying, they set me up on a date with a Fox News employee that I kind of had a thing for. I didn't realize that she was spying on me at the same time. On the other hand, you know, I think we could say this. All of this stuff about the secret bank accounts and all these and spying on people, the only reason we know about that is because Ailes is out. A lot of people would come forward, but the people who were really courageous were Gretchen Carlson's and probably Megyn Kelly, who stood up and said some things either in public or behind doors that actually forced Ailes out.
Right, right.
Okay, before we go, pop quiz for you guys. Okay, this is something that's turned into a bit of a meme online among journalists this week. Your first seven jobs, what were they?
Mike, you go first.
Okay, first job, hay baler. Okay, you're going to see that I lived in a small town in a rural area. Corn detasseler. I did all of those before I was 16. Dishwasher, fry cook, window washer. I actually washed the windows of a bank for a few weeks. Those were all while I was in high school, okay? I think that's five, right? Pizza delivery guy, first job in college. And I was the custodian on the floor at the University of Missouri Medical Center where they had all the brown recluse spiders. That was probably the scariest job and only lasted in that one for about 3 months. Those were my first seven jobs.
Well, let's see. I was a busboy, a clothing salesman, worked in toy store putting bikes together, a convenience store clerk, worked in the front desk at the dorm, worked as a token taker for Showbiz Pizza, which my wife still gives me grief for. And I would say my first job at newspapers was an agate clerk on Friday and Saturday nights for high school football, working in Fort Worth.
Okay, How about you, Amy?
Okay, so I spent some time thinking about this yesterday. If we go all the way back to babysitting, so starting as a babysitter at 11 or 12 years old, worked at a hot dog stand, which if you're familiar with Chicago style hot dogs, there's one almost anywhere you can imagine. It's like the staple for fast food. I was a grocery store checker, then was a freelance sports reporter, residence hall desk assistant, television reporter, television producer. This whole thing just kind of became a fun game where journalists started talking about it. And as we all started seeing these lists, and you can even see it among the lists for the three of us, there's a lot of diversity in life experience that we bring to these jobs.
And there is a serious element to this, as much fun as this was. I mean, what kinds of life experiences do our students or the new crop of journalists bring to the table? I'm not making any gross overgeneralizations here, but I do worry sometimes that maybe they've had an upbringing that's been so comfortable that many of them might not have had the kinds of job experiences that would cause them to actually empathize with people who do the kinds of labor that as young people we had to do. And if you think about the whole business with why Trump was so popular and Bernie Sanders was so popular, there's a whole bunch of folks out there that journalists don't relate to.
Well, and I also think, you know, you point to this, the economy. I mean, there were jobs for high school students. Mm-hmm. You did these types of jobs. Well, a lot of those jobs aren't out there anymore. Yeah. Or you have people who, because of the economy, who are older, taking the jobs that high school students, those of us, once did. And I think that's part of what we're seeing when we see our students is that they haven't had those opportunities because those jobs aren't there.
So it's kind of our job, don't you think, to expose our students, have exercises, story assignments, whatever, that force them to go out there and do that.
And we do that a little bit in our news writing class and in our cross-cultural journalism class. I'd like to point our listeners and viewers out to a fantastic piece that Bram Sablesmith here at KBIA did about a week ago, looking at overnight camps, having a hard time recruiting high school and college students to come to work because they feel like they need to go into professions that would be a little bit more in line with what they're going to do after college. Well, that music means we're out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today and a handful we didn't have time for on our links blog. It's all under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. You can watch our program again. You can also listen to it at kbia.org on YouTube and everywhere where you find your favorite podcasts, including the NPR One app. They're all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and Pat Akers for handling the audio for us.